Welcome to episode 69 of Ardent Run Club. I'm Tommy, I'm your host, and today I'm joined by a super athlete. He's from the Northeast. He's literally running around the world, literally. And when I say that, I mean he's run across the US, he's run across Australia, he's done parts of Europe. And yeah, like I say, he's doing the whole world. So we're going to be talking a lot about that today. It's Run Joy Run. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mark Allison. How you doing, Mark?
Great to be here. Thanks very much for having us on the show.
Hey, man.
I'm doing well, thanks.
Good to hear, pal. Thanks for joining me today. That introduction basically is like an overview of what we're going to be talking about today. The fact that you're running around the world, literally, that's nuts. Mm-hmm. So thanks for joining me. I guess I'd just love to get into that story from the get. So tell us about you. Tell us, when did you actually start running and what got you into it?
Well, my running possibly didn't start for the same reasons as many other people, but it didn't start in the best of circumstances for me, where my mum was cared for by a local hospice, St. Benedict's Hospice. And sadly, she passed away there in 1995. But, you know, the hospice did such a good job in terms of making her final days comfortable, and I felt I had a huge debt of gratitude to repay, you know, for the kindness and love and care that they showed her, the doctors, the nurses, all of the staff there. So this is back in 1995. And I thought, well, what can I do to raise funds to repay the hospice? You know, they rely heavily on charitable donations. Even though they're an NHS trust, they wouldn't be able to function without charitable donations. So I thought, well, I'm not one for a sponsored silence or sitting in a bathtub of beans or anything like that. So I thought, right, I'll see if I can run. And I set out running around the block. And I thought, oh, that's not too bad. And I spent the next while running 3 miles after 3 miles after 3 miles and never got any distance greater than that for quite some time. So, you know, this is still in the mid-90s, and yeah, those are my early footsteps on a much longer journey involved with running. So not in the best of circumstances, but I'm pleased to say that, you know, out of that huge negative and that terrible situation, a loss of my mom back then, that something hugely positive has come out of it. So, you know, that's incredibly important to me personally, as well as, you know, all of the funds that have come into the hospice since then.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about that then. So when did you break that 3 mile barrier, and what was that motivation?
Yeah, I mean, I got really quick and I lost a lot of weight pretty quickly, you know, and I'm sort of 23 year old at this point. And I used to work in Gateshead and I lived in Washington at the time. And I plotted this route out. I drove it in my car. It was 8.5 miles. And I thought, I wonder if I could run that 8.5 miles. And I got a lift into work one morning, took my kit, and after work, I ran back home 8.5 miles. And to me at the time, it seemed like a huge adventure, a huge step up from the numerous 3 mile runs that I ever used to do. And, you know, little did I realize at the time, but it was just a stepping stone onto greater distances and quicker times also. But yeah, it was a run from the center of Gateshead all the way down the Great North Road past where the Angel of the North was to be created. It wasn't there at the time. Down into Birtley, and there's a huge hill after that. I think that was the first time that I kind of realized that I quite enjoyed the pain and the suffering involved with running up steep hills.
Yeah.
And then there's a bridge up and over the A1, and it was a really good sprint finish. And I could almost hear the crowd in my mind's eye as I crossed the finish line at the other side of the A1 as I neared my house. So yeah,
nice.
good times. I wish I could run as quick as that now.
That's awesome, man. Wow. Well, I bet you never thought that you would take 3 miles to 8 miles and then to literally thousands of miles.
Yeah, I mean, there are other stepping stones in between. You know, that 8 mile run, it led me to think, well, I wonder if I could do the Great North Run. You know, you know, it's the biggest half marathon in the world. A lot of people that I knew had done it in the past, and that was equally adventurous and, you know, a brave thing to do, I thought at the time. You know, the Great North Run I did 2, 3, or 4 times, I think it was, before I then went on to the London Marathon, the New York Marathon. So learning the lessons from whatever distance and taking it on into the next kind of distance, and preparing and training appropriately for whatever distance was still to come. Yeah, so, you know, we're now talking sort of 99, the first time I did the New York Marathon. And then I was to do it again in 2001, just after the 9/11 terrorist attack, where for a time, you know, after September the 11th, 2001, it wasn't known if the New York Marathon would go ahead, but against all of the odds, I suppose it did go ahead, and I'm glad I did it, really. And that was a huge money spinner for the hospice back then, I remember. £2,000 or £3,000 was raised from that particular run.
Wow. So every single one of these runs was raising money for the hospice, was it?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't believe I've done an event of any magnitude without being sponsored for it. You know, I'm a runner, but I put myself as a fundraiser first. Yeah. You know, running for me is a means to an end, and that end is to raise as much money as I can for local charities in the Northeast. Mm. So, yeah, without the fundraising aspect, not have gone into running, I don't know.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's hard to say now.
Yeah. So before we get into the ultra crazy stuff, what's your favorite race that you've competed in / running, taking part in, I guess, is the best word?
Yeah. All of them have something to offer. Even the Great North Run, just I feel a lot of pride in coming from the northeast of England. And that route has been run by over 1 million people now. It's tremendously well supported. There was a time, sort of 20 odd years ago, where I noticed the crowds dwindled somewhat, but, you know, in recent years, certainly the last decade, the crowds are back with a force.
Yeah.
And it's just a great local event that has raised millions and millions for charities across the UK and the wider world, I would imagine.
Yeah.
But then again, London, superbly well supported. I generally only ever went to London to watch Newcastle play. So to spend a bit of time seeing 26.2 miles of sights was great. So, and the New York Marathon as well, you know, just seeing so many places that you've only ever seen in movies before, was absolutely tremendous. So yeah, some great events, you know, that to look back on there, and lots of happy memories that definitely did set me on a path to other things.
Yeah. I was going to say that your run in London would have been your only happy memory in London then.
I've been there when we beat Arsenal, for example, or Tottenham.
All right. I don't want to fight.
Yeah. An Andy Carroll header and a 1-0 victory, I seem to remember. That was a good time. Does nothing happen.
I don't like talking to football fans that know their stuff. Awesome. So you've done all these amazing events, Great North Run, London Marathon, New York, all this sort of stuff. But then what was the first thing that made you say, I want to do something crazy? Like, what was the next step?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question, and one that I get asked quite often. And two aspects to this, really. The first is that, you know, to get up to do a marathon major, you've got to get up very early in the morning. I'm not a morning person. And, you know, it's quite a task to get to a start line. So there's that. And I thought, I want to do my own events. You know, I want to get up when I want to get up and get to the start line when I want to. So that's quite a lazy aspect to it, I suppose. And secondly, you know, I realized that a lot of people are doing marathons and half marathons and raising funds, and there's a lot of competition in that space. You know, there's only so many pounds to be donated, and I wanted to raise a significant amount of money for St. Benedict's Hospice. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to separate myself from whatever anyone else is doing. And with that, in 2002, I ran the width of the country. It took me 7 days from Whitehaven to St. Benedict's Hospice in Sunderland. And that was the next step. And having said that, I was up at 6-7 o'clock every morning just to get to the start line. And then, yeah, be careful what you wish for, because I don't believe I haven't had too many lie-ins on any of the major runs that I've done. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, that was 2002. I did it again in 2003, that particular run, 134 miles, I believe it was. And yeah, I think the main motivation was the more miles I ran, the more difficult something was, the more challenging something was, the more logistically difficult, never mind running it, just getting to the start line is difficult. All of that as a package, people kind of buy into that and say, yeah, this is a difficult thing. This is worthy of sponsorship.
Yeah.
So with miles, the more miles that there are, comes more money for the charities, hopefully. And thankfully, that's proven to be the case over the years.
So how do you train for these things? Because it's not like your standard half marathon training set or your marathon training block or whatever. Like, you're just running 134 miles, you said.
Yeah, I mean, with that one, I didn't have much of a plan, you know, other than to be able to run at least one marathon distance. And I remember, well, thinking back now, my whole training regime was all about no rest and no recovery. You know, I'm sure the experts wouldn't condone that, but I think that's something that I've taken throughout my training, where you know, you run 20 to 30 miles one day, you've got to get up and do it again the next day.
Yeah.
So that certainly set the scene for those earlier distances. You know, those early major events back in 2002, 2003. I did variations of it. 2004, I think it was, around the Hadrian's Wall route. Nice. So another coast to coast, but slightly different. But I did it dressed as a Roman soldier. And not with a heavy metal kind of authentic armor. This was more like the kind of Roman soldier's outfit you would see in a stag do in Newcastle on a Saturday night. A rubber helmet, rubber sword, attracted a lot of attention. That was done in 3 days. That was good fun. I remember being stopped on the military road by a bus full of Japanese or Chinese tourists for photographs. That cost me 20 minutes in time, but it was good fun. I couldn't speak their language and vice versa. So just things like that stick in your memory. And I think the last time I ran the width of the country would have been 2005.
Yeah.
Again, that was a huge money spinner. And I think at that point, it was about £16,000 had been raised for St. Benedict's Hospice in just over a decade. But, you know, I wanted to raise even more. And I took 2006 off from raising funds to concentrate on a plan and to try and train to run John O'Groats to Land's End. So that was a huge step up in terms of difficulty, sacrifice, getting time off work and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
So 2007 saw that 874 mile distance done in 37 days, but it raised £34,000 for the hospice.
Wow.
So you can see where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
You know, started by running 3 miles around the block, half marathons, marathons, width of the country, length of the country. So yeah, 2007 was certainly a real challenging year in terms of distance. And just organizing a run of that magnitude was challenging also.
So did you ever do any short runs in between that?
Yeah, I mean, I used to run with people from work. I worked at Northern Rock in Gosforth, and in at that time there were some really good club runners.
Mm-hmm.
Worked in the IT department where I worked.
Yeah.
And, you know, people who've represented ELSIC, North Shields, Polly, you know, I was running Morpeth Harriers, Blythe. I used to run for Tainbridge Harriers back in 2012. I don't have the discipline or commitment to be a club runner. I take my hat off to those people who turn out week on week for Tuesday and Thursday training and cross country on a weekend perhaps, or a park run, and you know, build up their race calendar and diary. It's tremendous commitment, which, you know, I've got much bigger things on the horizon, which I just don't have the time to commit to that type of thing.
Fair enough.
It was a really good running culture back then, and ran with some brilliant people. And the odd time I was able to put in a decent standard of pace and distance of a lunchtime.
That's awesome. And so when you said, so you ran the length of the country, 874 miles, did you say?
Yeah.
And did you run every day of that?
I was supposed to. I had one rest day. I had a contingency day at the end, just to mop up any surplus miles that I might be behind.
Yeah.
But I suffered terrible shin splints. I started John O'Groats, traveling south, and the shin problems started around Edinburgh. So about 300 miles into that run, and the money was coming in. It's not that I could have given up. I certainly felt I couldn't give up.
Yeah.
So I was on paracetamol, codeine, ibuprofen, gels that I rubbed on my shins, which had no effect whatsoever. I got a hamstring issue. I had to take a day off when I got back to the Northeast. So one day off.
Yeah.
By the time I got to, I would say, Preston in the northwest of the country, the hamstring problem had solved itself. Good. The shin splints, which seemed to be associated with running up and downhill, that had sorted itself out. And I was getting lighter every day. I was getting fitter every day.
Yeah.
And finished that run with a bit of style in the end. But it took me one day than I'd originally planned to do that run in. But I had a contingency day there for such things. So it all worked out in the end.
Okay, fair enough. And then what was the next thing then? So after running the length of the country, after you had your plan all in place in 2007, what was on the horizon for anything else?
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite an impressionable person. And I think having watched Forrest Gump in the same year that my mum died, you know, it might sound far-fetched to say this, but I'm sure that affected me in some ways, even though that's a fictional character. It's, to me, it seemed like the next logical step. That might sound insane for me to say that, but when you run the length of the UK, to run the width of another continent didn't seem too strange, for want of a better word. It didn't seem too alien a concept. Yes, it would be difficult. Yes, it would take a lot of planning and unprecedented effort and what have you. I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. I've just got to, you know, put one foot in front of the other. You know, if you put one foot in front of the other, you get your destination in the end, don't you? So that took me 2008, 9 and 10 to fundraise, to plan and prepare and save up for the actual run from California to New York in 2011. You know, that cost £15,000 of my own money to do. £9,000 of which was for a motorhome, where myself and the support team would sleep every night.
Yeah.
The support team had to be recruited. Like me, they were unpaid volunteers.
Yeah.
I just about got enough people on the support team to stretch the width of the country and 100 days of support.
Yeah.
So that you know, it might seem strange when I say it, but America seemed like the next logical step, the next logical thing to do in terms of running and fundraising.
That's nuts. And what do you remember the exact route that you took then from LA to New York?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, if you showed me, you know, if I was to log on to Google Maps, for example,
yeah,
I reckon I'd be 99.9% accurate in being able to trace the road that I ran on. You know, I'd spent 3 years planning that route to take in the Mojave Desert, the Rocky Mountains, Berthoud Pass at 11,300 feet, 1,000 miles of Route 36. Can you imagine being 1,000 miles on the same road? And I knew for 3 years prior to that run, it was going to be difficult.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that for 1,000 miles, it would all look the same. You know, I would pass cornfield after cornfield after cornfield. Right. And until I got, you know, that 1,000 miles started around Denver. And by which point, you know, I'd spent 5 or 6 weeks at altitude of 4,500 feet or above. So I was in really good shape. So coming off that altitude out of the Rocky Mountains and onto that 1,000 mile stretch, I've probably been the fittest I've ever been in my life. Mm-hmm. I started that run, unfortunately, in California at 18 and a half stone, hugely overweight. In May 2010, I broke my ankle. This is 10 months before the run across America was due to start. So I was in plaster for a while and just lost discipline, lost a lot of momentum that I'd gained in training, put all the weight back on that I'd lost. So yeah, it took quite a while to get that weight back off in America. But by the time I was on Route 36, the other side of that 1,000 miles was Indianapolis. I was in really good shape, by which point you've got one of the hottest summers on the American that's ever been seen in America. At that point, unfortunately, unseasonably warm. And, you know, that led to a lot of problems, but got through it. And yeah, to answer your original question, talking about it now, I can visualize in my mind's eye Indianapolis, Denver, Springfield, Columbus, Ohio, yeah, and so on and so forth, all the way to Coney Island, New York, where it finished on day 100. You know, it was a tremendous 100 days. It achieved what I hoped it would and more. And when I say and more, I'd hoped to raise £50,000 for St. Benedict's Hospice. And I was also raising funds for the Children's Foundation.
Yeah.
But thanks to the generosity of so many thousands of people, £106,000 was raised as a result of that run. So it was, it's the one I look back on with most fondness for sure.
That's amazing. And how many miles was that?
So 3,100 miles in 100 days. And you'd think that, yeah, all you've got to do is run 31 mile a day on average. However, at one point, I was about 175 miles behind schedule.
Crud.
And I say at one point, well, that was about with 3.5 weeks to go to the end. So I had 175 miles to make up in, you know, the final 3 weeks, plus the 31 miles a day I should have been running.
Yeah.
So as far as I remember, with 3 days to go, I'd got it down to 155 miles to the finish line.
Good.
With 2 days to go, there was 105 miles to do. And on the final day in New Jersey, there was 60 miles to the finish line in New York. So 60 miles on day 100 of the run across America, where, you know, I was worried at one point with 3 days to go, would I even get to the finish line on time? Would I raise £50,000? You know, it was getting very close to that fundraising target that I'd set myself.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, Run Jody Run started to trend on Twitter. Celebrities such as Gordon Ramsay and newsreaders, Sophie from the BBC, started to tweet about the run, and the money just came in by the thousands.
Wow.
So at the end of that 60-mile day, that final day, the fundraising total sat at £63,000, which was tremendous. I thought that's a brilliant amount to raise.
Yeah.
And it's been worth all of this sacrifice and effort. But 3 or 4 weeks later, the money was still coming in, and it was to finish at £106,000. I'm sure that more money came in when I wasn't running across America. but that was the first time that the brand of Run Geordie Run was used. And I think people, you know, that sentence, those three words, speak for itself, really. You know?
Yeah. So how did you come up with the
name? Sorry, say again?
How did you come up with the name Run Geordie Run?
Yeah, I think Run Geordie Run. I think my first choice was Run Fat Boy Run.
Okay.
Because I was quite overweight at the time while running.
Right.
But unfortunately, a movie of the same name came out around that time. So, that one's taken. And then, again, quite a logical thing, Run Geordie Run, Run Forest Run. You know, I was running across America like Forrest Gump did. It was just a logical name, and it's stuck ever since.
Yeah.
So sometimes people just call me that, or Mr. Run, or RGR. I get that quite a lot at work.
Yeah. That's better than Run Fat Boy Run.
Exactly. Yeah.
Hindsight, you're like, better.
Because at the end of that run across America, I'd lost 5.5 stone.
There you go.
I was 8% body fat at the end of that run. And in the condition of my life. So it wouldn't have made sense. Until that is, I got back home and started eating pies and bacon sandwiches again.
The diet is not is not for runners. It's not for athletes.
No.
So on these crazy expeditions across countries and across continents, where do you actually sleep?
So on that particular run across America, we had a motorhome, which we picked up in California. And quite literally that would drive down the road 10, 15, 20 miles or sometimes to the finish line if I needed to get the miles in and I was able to be self-sufficient. So wherever it was able to park, that's where myself and the support team, the motorhome in America was huge. So it could sleep 7 people. And really comfortable at that as well. So yeah, at the roadside, I think we might have had 4 or 5 campsites in a 100-day period. So mainly roadsides, quite a few Walmart car parks. It seemed, for whatever reason, Walmart encouraged people to stay overnight in their parking lots, possibly from a security point of view, keep an eye on things, I don't know. Yeah. So there were quite a few Walmarts. I noticed on Route 36, we used to get woken up quite a bit with police wanting to know what on earth we were doing there. In the middle of nowhere, it's hardly a tourist sort of neck of the woods, as it were. And then a couple of years later, I started to watch Breaking Bad and realized that, all the stuff they were getting up there was in a motorhome in the middle of nowhere. So
that's why they were asking questions.
Yeah. So, officer, that smell is my feet. We're not getting up to no good here.
Oh my goodness. Actually, random question pops into my mind. Speaking of feet, did you get crazy blisters on these runs as well?
America was really good. 2 weeks, the first 2 weeks, blisters every day. You name a place on my feet and I got a blister, but they were managed really well. My feet were cleaned regularly. That was pretty good. But as towards the last 2 weeks of that run, with no blisters in between, I might add, but as soon as the mileage increased towards the end, the 40s, the 45s, the 50s, the 60-mile days, that really did take its toll on my feet. We ran out of water with 3 days to go in America, with no time whatsoever to restock. Yeah. It was eat, sleep, run, and repeat. And just no time for the support team to do anything in terms of replenishing resources such as water. So, my feet hygiene wasn't brilliant then. First 2 weeks and the last 2 weeks in America, feet weren't in great condition.
Fair enough. No, you had to do what you had to do. And on the America run, and this will probably be the last one before we move over to Australia, what was your best day on that run?
I mean, it's hard to look past day 100, where everyone on Twitter, it seemed to me, was talking about Run Jordy Run. I was, you know, a huge amount of credit must go to Real Radio at the time, and Gary Phillipson and Lisa Shaw, who sadly passed away last year, covered the run extensively week after week. In fact, it was a good 18 months prior to the run kicking off that I was to appear on the breakfast show. So I wasn't really aware of the Twitter thing at the time, to the extent that that I was later to realize how massive the run was. Chris Moyles on Radio 1 was talking about the run for 6 minutes with a few days to go, which is a lot of airtime on that kind of scale, which was massive. So day 100, everything seemed to come together. I finished at a time on Coney Island where it was prime time breakfast time for the UK audience.
Nice.
And people had been staying awake overnight, checking social media, and stayed awake for the breakfast show, the Real Radio breakfast show with Gary and Lisa. It's hard to talk about without, you know, I'm getting pretty choked up just talking about Gary and Lisa. You know, they were a huge part of why that run was successful.
Yeah.
Yes, it had great support, but they elevated that run on such a scale that meant that the money just poured into the charities. So day 100 USA, best day of that run. And you know, there are some other days that aren't too far behind, but yeah, day 100.
That's awesome. That's so amazing. I'm assuming they were you got a couple 3 minute videos on YouTube. I'm assuming they were the people that were speaking in the mid, that you were speaking to over the phone or something.
Yeah, that's right. You would have heard Gary and Lisa on that montage. I used to be the highlight of the week.
Yeah.
You know, I'd run, you know, 200 mile a week, say, and being able to speak to those at the end of the week about the experience was really special.
Yeah.
From a personal point of view, as well as being able to get the word out that I'm raising funds for two great Northeast charities, and please donate what you can.
Yeah. Well, must be very, very thankful for all they could do.
Yeah. I mean, I'm grateful to Gary and Lisa, so many other people. If I was to sit and write down a long list of names, it would take days to do.
Wow.
And there's a lot of people who've donated that I'll never be able to thank. I don't know who they are. You know, they've randomly donated time and time again. Right back from 1995, there are names I don't recognize on a sponsor form or as you know, the internet came about in terms of Just Giving or Virgin Money Giving. If you take a step back and think about that generosity, it's quite something.
Yeah.
It's something I'll never take for granted, that's for sure. And it's something I hope continues in the future because, you know, there's still a lot of miles to be run and still a lot of money to be raised.
Yeah. And it's amazing because if you've got that many people donating, you've got people donating a lot and you must have people donating a little and it just all adds up.
That's a great point because some analysis I did after the run across America, I found that £50,000 of the £106,000 that was raised, £50,000 was made up of donations of £10 or less. So people, you know, you hear it all the time, sorry, I can't give much more. But you add all of those amounts up, £50,000 is a significant amount to any charity. Wow. So you might not think you're making a difference, but believe you me, you make such a massive difference. You know, collectively, we can do great things. And I've seen that time and time again over the years.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Wow. Right, let's move over to Australia. So I understand you did that one in the middle of summer.
It was turned out to be the hottest Australian summer on record. In the true spirit of Run Jordy Run, if something can be complicated, if something can be difficult, if something can be challenging, it generally is. So, I wouldn't have it any other way.
Oh, my goodness. All right. So when did you do that one? What year was that?
So that started in October 2013, late spring, in terms of the Australian seasons. And it was probably only a few weeks after the run across America I decided in my own head what the next logical step was. I keep talking about these next logical steps from a 3 mile run around the block, all of a sudden contemplating running the width of Australia.
Everyone's thinking, how is that logical?
yeah. It, as I said before, it seems strange possibly to other people to hear that, but that's just how my mind works, I suppose.
Yeah.
So yeah, it took, I mean, it was only 18, 19 months of prep, really. But I couldn't afford to do that myself. I had to reach out to the commercial sector to pay the tour costs. They were £15,000 again, 9,000 of which was for a motorhome, same as us, as America. Flights, insurance, fuel, that all added up to £15,000 to do that run. So there was some money surplus which went to the charities, which was excellent. And all of the public money therefore went to the Sir Bobby Robson Foundation and the Children's Foundation. Those were the two charities there. So October 16th, I was stood on Cottesloe Beach, just outside of Perth. And you'd be mistaken for thinking you were on Whitley Bay Beach. It was in the winter. It was dark, cloudy, huge waves. I thought, oh, I'm in for an easier time here. This Australian summer is not going to be too bad after all.
Yeah.
But 30 mile into that day, the temperature really started to soar. And I think I ran 40, 41 mile that first day. Finished at 9 o'clock at night. And yeah, I knew I was in for a torrid time in terms of temperature back then. So that was going to take 72 days I'd scheduled it to do that run in. So I knew I had ahead of me 70 or so days of difficult running.
Yeah. Wow. And did you get it done in the 72 days?
Of course I didn't. America, had I taken 101 days, it would have, for me at the time, felt like I'd, trained for, say, the Olympics and finished just outside of a medal position. So I'm so pleased that was done in 100 days. But the Australia run was so difficult, so challenging, extremely painful on my feet. That just getting to the end was the aim. Just finishing that run was all that mattered in the end.
Yeah.
And from midway through the second day, right through to the final day, I was surrounded by flies, thousands and thousands and thousands of flies every single day.
Yeah.
They're not as bad as British flies, in my experience. This sounds insane the way I'm talking about flies, but bear with me. There is a point. British flies want to bite you anywhere, where the Aussie flies, they just need the moisture out of your ears, nose, mouth, eyes, just to get that protein, I suppose, to reproduce or feed. I don't know. So as long as you've got a fly net, and a set of earphones to keep the constant buzzing away, it was quite manageable.
All right.
But that meant the support team, for the most part, were trapped inside the motorhome in temperatures of up to 45 Celsius.
Yes.
And some evenings, particularly later on in that run, sort of day 60 onwards, the temperature at night was just unbearable. 36 Celsius inside. No chance of opening any windows to let the draft that wasn't even there anyway in because of flies and mosquitoes were a problem. So lack of sleep, 40 miles a day, running on a hard shoulder of the road that was very sharp in the surface. The Australian roads, they put the molten tarmac down, throw the bitumen stone on top, and let the traffic bed that in. And of course, my hard shoulder, which varied from 10 centimeters to maybe a meter, depending on whereabouts in the country I was. That never got bedded in, so I was, for the most part, running on sharp stones. There was one period of time I didn't shower for 12 days, so foot hygiene, or even personal hygiene, wasn't the best. I think I must have created new smells when I was out there that have never been experienced by mankind. So that all adds up to a lot of unpleasantness. And yeah, once the physical side goes and your morale goes, there's some pretty hard days. And I think the lowest times I've ever had around the world have been in Australia. Horrendous times, but the money kept pouring in for the Sir Bobby Robson Foundation and the Children's Foundation. Ultimately, £60,000 almost was raised in respect of that run. So again, it was mission accomplished.
Yeah.
But it wasn't without a huge amount of difficulty and pain. You know, I was on paracetamol and ibuprofen. Like they were Smarties. Like they were, you know, sweets. They were just part of my daily or almost hourly routine just to keep the pain under control.
Goodness me, that can't be healthy.
No, definitely not. And I hardly take a painkiller now. It's very much a last resort if ever I'm in any pain. So
yeah. Wow. So and what was the total distance across Australia?
So that was 2,384 miles. And I think was about 2,200 miles in. Or rather, there was about 180 miles still to go, and it was so difficult that I couldn't run anymore. You know, the bit in Forrest Gump where he's followed by all those people and he just stops running in near Monument Valley.
Yeah,
that was like me. I just stopped 180 miles from the finish line, with about 74 days behind me, and I thought, yeah, physically I can do it, but mentally I could not put one foot in front of the other. And it was so difficult. And I had some accommodation booked in Sydney. And my wife was on the support team at the time, Donna. And we drove back to Sydney. And I thought, well, nearly made it. Good amount of money had been raised. I think it was maybe £39,000-£40,000, the charity total at that time. And I thought, well, we nearly made it. And then I woke up the next morning and I was sent the headline from the front page of the journal, the local newspaper. And I'm paraphrasing, but it said something like, so near yet so far, still a hero, blah, 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 all of that type of stuff. And then it started to sink in with me that, you know, I'm referred to as, oh, that's the guy who ran across America. Well, what would I be known as now? That's the guy who almost ran across Australia. It didn't seem quite right to me. In fact, the whole thing didn't seem quite right. Unfinished run, unfinished business. But I think that was the first time I really learned what being resilient is about. And being resilient is about, you know, sometimes if something's so incredibly tough, challenging, stressful, you just need to take a step back, take a step out of a situation, which is what I believe I did then. And of course, I had two rest days, resumed where I'd left off. We'd handed the motorhome back. So sleeping in a hire car after running 40 mile a day for the final four or five days, and got to the finish line.
Wow.
And, you know, nearly £60,000 raised. So got to the finish line, but totally different experience to the America run.
Yeah.
Australia is not the kind of country that you plan to run across and expect everything to go perfectly.
Yeah.
I've always needed a plan A and a plan B and a plan C. I think I was on a plan G or H in Australia, that's for sure. Yeah. But Liz, you know, learned that sometimes, yeah, you just need to remove yourself and come back at it a bit stronger, if that's hours later, days later, or whatever. For me, thankfully, it was only a few days.
Yeah.
And I was able to complete the challenge to get to, it was a place called Shell Harbour, next to the ocean, and dipped my feet in the beach. And 6 hours later, I was on a plane back to the UK. So that one ended well, thankfully.
That's awesome. I hope you didn't kill any animals in that beach with your feet.
No, but she won't thank me for saying this, but Donna, my wife, she ran over something on the final day in the hire car. It was, the early hours of the morning. I had to navigate a place called Macquarie Pass, a place full of switchback roads through quite a bit of jungle land. Yeah, she ran over something. And as we were driving to the airport, it must have caused a radiator leak and we broke down. So just about managed to get the flight in the end. It was quite an exciting, although an unwanted exciting end to an incredibly tough 82 days.
Yeah. Oh, man. And that's, that one reason, I mean, Australia's just got a lot of animals that you just don't want to go near. Like, even in that, in your YouTube video, there's just a snake on the cover. You could just be running and just end up stepping on a snake.
I didn't see many snakes. I think they're more afraid of humans and vice versa, although I beg to differ sometimes. But I could see them in the distance. In the early days of the Australia run, when I was running across the Nullarbor, I could generally see, when I had my head torch on, it's pitch black and there's no civilization around for hundreds of miles. You kind of look up to the horizon and I could see two eyes, maybe 200-300 meters away. Was it human? Was it not? No idea.
That's creepy. What?
So
that's weird.
Once I got past Adelaide, there were plenty of emus, kangaroos were a daily sight, but hadn't seen much of those at all in the the first 1500 miles, say.
That's nuts, man. Oh, awesome. All right. And so after that, after the Australia run, what was next? You go back home to the drawing board and think of the next logical step?
Well, I didn't really know what the next logical step was when I was thinking about it. People speculated it would be China, South America, Africa. And this may sound really corny, but it came to me in a dream. So I got back from that Australia run early January 2014. I'd have to check Twitter for the exact date, but it was sometime towards the end of January 2014 where this dream that I had, I could see a globe and I could see lines around the globe representing places that I'd run before. So John O'Groats to Land's End, America and Australia. And in the dream, I thought, what a shame, that's not all joined up. Those lines aren't joined up. I think I woke up during the night and put on Twitter something to that effect where it's come to us now in a dream, the next step. I'll think about it in the morning when I wake up. So, the next step for me was to complete those lines around the world and run quite literally on land around the world in a respectable route that obviously just wouldn't be around the top of the North Pole, for example. But I wanted to know what running around the world actually meant. So I looked for Guinness World Record criteria. There wasn't much in terms of running, but in cycling, I think the criteria is 18,000 miles, all in the same direction. There are other criteria as well, but I thought, well, let's do 20,000 miles, make it respectable. All on land, all joined up. So that's when I decided, right, there's Europe and all of that continent all the way to Shanghai to conquer. Let's throw in Japan and let's throw in New Zealand as well. So that was the next bit. And I'm halfway across that European continent with runs in 2016 and 2018 that were to follow.
Okay. So what have you done so far in Europe?
So 2016, I started in Lisbon, Portugal.
Yeah.
Ran due north all the way to the top left-hand corner of Spain near La Coruña. That was the other bit of criteria that I meant to mention.
Oh, yeah.
So with cycling, you've got to go through antipodal points, opposite points of the planet. The two points that I chose were somewhere in near La Coruña, The opposing point to that is in New Zealand.
Okay.
And it was, I think it was next to a bakery in New Zealand. And I thought, yeah, I'll get there eventually and I'll get myself a few pies. I've since fine-tuned the exact point in near La Coruña to the point in New Zealand, and it's a school play yard the last time that I checked. So I'll be getting in touch with that school to say I've once been in the exact opposite point of the planet to where your school is. And although I did record a piece from La Coruña and send them it at the time, but I've never heard a response. So that's one to chase up for sure.
Yeah,
but getting back to 2016, headed along the north coastline of Spain, which, looking back, wasn't such a great idea, because as the crow flies, it's one particular distance, but with all of the jagged inlets and switchback roads that hug the coastline, I could see my destination more often than not just over the way there, but I had to run quite a way inland to then come back out to the coast to get there. And of course that took in then the Pyrenees and a lot of climbs that you see on the Tour de France. The Col de Tourmalet and into Andorra, you know, so many Col de Puri-Sword, so many climbs. And if anyone who knows me knows one thing, it's I do love a climb. And just to get stuck into the Rocky Mountains, the Appalachians in the eastern part of the USA were incredibly challenging. And just to be in the Pyrenees was, yeah, I was in my element. So difficult when you're running 35 to 40 miles a day with that kind of elevation.
Yeah.
But the challenge that goes with that, and, you know, it keeps your mind occupied, the scenery, it's so stimulating that, great places to run.
Yeah.
And yeah, Andorra, which is basically one huge uphill till you get out of the other side of the country. And then across France to Mont Ventoux, which you see quite often. I think they did it twice last year in the Tour de France, the cyclists. You see that quite often. And then into the French Alps, which arguably I've had some of my finest days running in the French Alps.
Really?
There's one particular day, possibly a day 47 or 48, started one particular climb and ended up on the Col de la Madeleine with 35, 36 miles of running as if I was running on the flat.
Really?
I wish I could plan to run like that. What my nutrition must have been like, my hydration, I was at altitude, everything, the stars were all aligned that particular day. Mm. The Col de la Madeleine, tremendous days running.
Wow.
And once I got out of the Alps, it was across northern Italy and into the Italian Alps. And of course, the Stelvio Pass, which I've been back and did a one-off sponsored event, ran it the other way. The Stelvio Pass is a quite incredible place, covered in snow now, of course. But not when I was there. And then it was a case of going into Austria, Slovenia, Croatia, and 2016's finish line should have been Istanbul, but thanks to a military coup, that put Peter that finish line. I lost the finish line, so I had to come up with a plan B. Wow. So I thought, right, I'm going to finish in Belgrade. The money was coming into the charities. I was on day 53. I was an unprecedented 35 miles ahead of schedule.
Nice.
Where, you know, you run 35 to 40 miles a day on average and you're ahead of schedule. That's never been seen before. That's the one stage around the world I've had rest days strategically placed, either at the foot of the Pyrenees or the foot of the Alps. I've taken those rest days and I've benefited from them. Again, resilience in action, you know. Take a step back, rest, refuel, come back stronger. And to lose the finish line because of some activity in Turkey was really disappointing. So it was at that point I thought, right, I need to change the finish line. Let's get to Belgrade.
Yeah.
in Serbia. We'll call it a day there, come back to the UK and do the next stage in a couple of years' time, either going on to Turkey when things settle down, or possibly taking a more northerly route through Romania, Kiev, Ukraine, Russia, Kazakhstan, that kind of route, more northerly route. So, yeah, 2016 was, I think it was 2,600 miles. Again, almost £60,000 raised. So the fundraising target had been well and truly smashed again.
Yeah.
And that, I think I took 770 odd days as well. So
brilliant, yeah.
Another successful campaign.
Yeah. And then 2018, you go back to see if you can get it done again.
Yeah, 2018. So at this point, every stage around the world, you know, even Johnny Groats to Land's End back in 2007 had become a world stage, whether it liked it or not. And America was stage two, Australia stage three. It's how I started to view things now. But it was getting more difficult in terms of getting a support team in. And I couldn't imagine taking a British motorhome into the places that I was now running.
Yeah.
We had to drive a motorhome back from Belgrade, for example, and I know how difficult that was. So I had to come up with a way in 2018 of being self-sufficient, not relying on a support team, not relying on a motorhome to sleep in. But when you're running through the Carpathian Mountains in Ukraine, for example, or in the middle of nowhere in Romania, what does that actually mean? How do I actually do that? So there was one of my very good sponsors dating back to the run across America. They made a really generous donation to the hospice, I remember back then. That's when they started to get involved. But there's a company called Chapman Ventilation who paid for the production of what I can only call my buggy. So it's a carbon fiber capsule on three wheels. I'm attached to it via a standard snow sled harness. It's 70 kilograms in weight. That's when it's empty. It's about 110 kilograms when it's full of water, laptop, shoes, kit, etc. So, 2018 was the first time that I used this capsule paid for by Chapman Ventilation. It got the nickname Chappie as a result of that. So I used Chappie to run up to 35 miles a day, and I can't run as quickly as I can when I'm not pulling Chappie behind me.
Yeah.
But it's the thing that allows me now to run distances unsupported. If I was to put a figure on it, I could probably last 2 weeks with adequate food and water in there without you know, restocking and resupplying. Possibly longer if I had the skills to be able to the survival skills that I don't quite have. Running with a support team is one thing, and running out of water in Australia is one thing. But yeah, when the book stops with me on my own in the middle of nowhere, that's something else. So, but yeah, Chappie is the thing that I'll use now, I would imagine, to get across the rest of that continent.
Difficult pulling Chappie?
Yeah, it certainly is. I've never managed more than 14-minute miles.
Wow.
So it's a real plod. It's a real trek. You expend far more calories per mile pulling that than you would, at, say, an 8-minute mile pace. It's extremely challenging. And when you've got the kind of elevation that I saw in the Carpathian Mountains in Ukraine, it's like literally pulling a ton weight behind up a hill. Fortunately, going down the other side of a hill, I've got a brake, and I'm so I can just put the brakes on, and I'm connected to it via aluminium poles, so it won't run into the back of me. So we've thought of that. It's got a solar panel on and some USB ports inside, so I can charge my Garmin watch, I can charge my laptop, update the blog, etc. So
yes.
It's great to be able to travel under my own steam, but it slows you down, not just because of its weight. and the fact you've got to pack it up every night. The hard part is climbing inside. You know, say you've run 30 to 35 miles, getting in that thing feet first is quite difficult. But once inside, you feel very safe, which is just as well, because the Carpathian Mountains, where there's quite a few bears, you want to be protected by something with a decent shell on it. So in fact, in Ukraine, I saw a sign. It was a huge sort of sign by the road as I really got into the mountains, and there were the photographs of bears and Ukrainian writing. I didn't know if that Ukrainian writing, in my mind, it was saying, beware of the bears, they're very hungry, or so I took a picture of it, sent it to a contact that I'd made earlier on that particular week. He got back to me 8 or 9 hours later the next day saying, it's a sign that says, don't shoot the bears. I wish I'd known that 8 or 9 hours before, thinking I was going to be eaten alive during the night. So,
So they're more or less friendly than those flies in Australia.
Yes. Although I wouldn't like to fully put that to the test.
That's awesome, man. And so how far did you get in 2018 then? What's the next step?
So that was 808 miles. I should have gone all the way to Kazakhstan, but I had a Russian visa. And that window that visa spanned was forever shrinking. It was, as I said before, progress with Chappy is slow. I underestimated that. But also, when you see a foreign person attached to something like Chappy, you want to ask questions. And even though I couldn't speak Ukrainian, for the most part, the people I spoke to or communicated with couldn't speak English. I got asked to speak at schools, universities, English-speaking groups. And all of a sudden, it wasn't just a fundraising venture, but a kind of humanitarian one as well. And I think a lot of people were inspired, particularly in Ukraine, by what they saw and what I had to say. Yeah. And of all of the countries that I've ever run in, I didn't know what to expect in Ukraine. But as I've said many times, and I wrote on my blog at the time, that it's the friendliest place I've ever been in.
Wow.
I think one thing I've noticed around the world, and particularly with fundraising, the less people have, the more that they want to give and offer. You know, I met so many kind people in that country, with so many great stories that I could talk for hours about. And I have done recently on social media, given especially what's going on in the country at the moment, just to kind of recollect all those great times and all of the kindness that was shown. There was one guy on a bike who was cycling alongside me while I was running. He couldn't speak English, and I was with him for about 4 hours. We could only communicate in football players' names, particularly the England 1966 World Cup winning team. And he knew a lot of Tom Jones songs. So I had 4 hours of him singing Sex Bomb alongside while I was running. and Delilah.
Oh, man.
And talking about Bobby Charlton, Jack Charlton, Bobby Moore. Oh, great.
Any Andrei Shevchenko?
No. There might have been, but I couldn't understand. But in Ukraine, and Romania and Serbia for that matter, when I was attached to Chappy, whenever there was an obvious language barrier, all I would have to do was point from the direction that I'd been running from and say some place names back there, and point forwards and say some place names. And that got the message across that I was running, you know, a huge distance. So
yeah.
I must have had hundreds of those types of conversations. Yeah. On that last stage in 2018.
Yeah, that's something as well, actually, to be fair. You're doing this, going around the world, but the amount of people you must meet, just must hear so many stories and get to know.
Yeah. I mean, in America, I probably just look like another runner running out on a lunchtime or on an evening or whatever. You know, there wasn't much to stand out. Australia, yeah, you're in the middle of the outback. You're certainly not on a lunchtime jog, that's for sure. So it's quite obvious that something extraordinary is going on there. Mm. Europe, yeah, again, pretty much just I could have been a runner running along the north coast of Spain. But when you've got Chappie in tow, you know, questions are asked. You know, there's a lot of curious people, and while it does hamper your progress, I think it's a really fascinating and really valuable aspect of what I do.
Yeah,
I'm fundraising, but also, and I've seen this over the years as well. And that, again, it's something I don't take for granted. But I've been told I inspire people, and you know, if I inspire one or two people to run, you know, that's a great added benefit to what I do.
Yeah.
Just like I was inspired years and years ago by people that to run in the first place. So yeah, it's a real kind of added bonus to what I do, I suppose.
Yeah, fantastic. Amazing. So what's next? You training for anything?
Well, I'm trying to get my weight down. The next window of opportunity for a world stage is 2024. It was last year, but the pandemic has put paid to that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know, I took 8 months off work last year, and it was the perfect window to go back to Kiev, where I finished in 2018. And a couple of weeks of running in Ukraine, into Russia, and to Nur Sultan in Kazakhstan should have been the plan last year, but COVID has put pay to that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I still fundraised. I still raised £13,000 just doing local things. So it wasn't a wasted year by any means. So the next window of opportunity is 2024. Mm. And whether and when I'll be able to go back to Kiev and Ukraine, goodness only knows.
Yeah.
But there's still, you know, options in terms of possibly starting in Kazakhstan, crossing into China. My ideal route is to go Kazakhstan into Russia and then into Mongolia to Shanghai. I mean, that's incredibly tough, and it will take a lot of planning and preparation and research to do that.
Yeah.
And that will be with Chappie. You know, that will have to be with Chappie and unsupported. You know, I don't think we could, it wouldn't be financially viable to try and get a vehicle, fuel it, insure it, and so on. It just wouldn't be worth it. You know, there has to be a massive return on investment for charities. And generally £10,000 to £15,000 is what these runs cost to do. And going forwards, the Chappie cost £19,000.
Wow.
So Chappie is the thing that will make sure that we get a really good return when it's safe to run those final countries on that continent.
Yeah.
So that leaves, in terms of my world route, that leaves Japan, South Island and North Island. Now, can you imagine taking that buggy, being a British man, running in Japan, and the interest that would bring locally?
Yeah.
I think that would be a fascinating journey.
Yeah, it'd be a long.
Yeah, it's just over 2,000 miles, the particular route from north to south.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I can acquire the skills to be able to film better, film more, and be a better editor, I think that's where the value in that room will be, not just in its execution, but to create a story or a series of videos on the back of that. If we're talking about around the world, I've done Australia, obviously. So finally, there is New Zealand from north to south, which I always wanted to be the final sort of leg around the world.
Yeah.
It just makes perfect sense to me that South Island, New Zealand is where all of this should end. And I always wanted to be stood there with 20,000 miles having been run. And of course, 10,000 miles has been run so far. So
yeah,
I'm halfway there in terms of distance around the world. My ultimate aim is to raise £500,000 for charities. Mm-hmm. And £340,000 has been raised so far.
Wow.
So while I'm halfway around the world in terms of distance, way over, way over halfway in terms of fundraising, which is absolutely tremendous. And the generosity is, as I said numerous times, is quite something.
Yeah.
So that's what's left to do. And I'm busy researching, thinking I need to talk to, you know, my wife, who knows what it's all about, previous members of the support team that I trust and have had the experience with me, to see what is possible. Do I take Chappie to Japan? Do I have a support team there and look to do it in, you know, a 40 mile a day type of event, which will be very difficult, very challenging. So there's a lot up in the air at the moment. If it wasn't for the war that Russia has waged on Ukraine, it would be a lot simpler because I'd be going back to Kiev, but I should know exactly where in the next few months.
Yeah.
But all I can do in the meantime is pencil in 2024 to continue the journey around the world.
That's massive, man. That's massive. But so far, over these 10,000 miles, what is the biggest thing you've learned about yourself as a runner?
I think as a runner, when you've got guts and when you've got a plan, those two things, guts and a plan, with those things, anything is possible.
Yeah.
And you pretty much don't need anything other than a good dose of discipline on top of that and effort. But have the guts, have the courage, but also have a good plan in place. And anything is capable. You know, that's without doubt the answer to that question.
That's awesome. Now I just wrote that down. Guts and a plan. That sounds like it extends way beyond just running as well. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I do a lot of things on gut instinct. So while I have a good high level outline plan, sometimes those plans change. But you know, there's always a long game being played, if you like, long term aims, as well as, you know, short term and medium term goals as well. You know, those things are really important. Having an overall plan, but having that broken down into short, medium, and long-term goals, I think, is crucially important, especially to the likes of me anyway.
Yeah. Awesome. That's amazing. Cool. Well, we've been on a journey here, and we've been going. So we're going to enter the family round, and it's just a few quick questions I've got just to get some a bit more. Yeah, we'll wrap up after that. So you ready to give it a go?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Fantastic. All right. So what is a race or an event that you've always wanted to do?
Well, I've run in Death Valley before. And Death Valley in America. And there's a race out there called Badwater 135, which is, you start at below sea level in Badwater in Death Valley, and you finish 8,500 feet, as far as I remember, up at Mount Whitney portal. So the bit you can drive to before you then climb Mount Whitney. But yeah, if you Google Badwater 135 and you see, and that's done in the height of summer as well, and you see some of the states that people are in, they're in ice baths with only their nose poking out of the water.
Yeah.
It's the type of run you need to be invited to. You know, it's not a type of run I'll ever get invited to do. But that's something I would love to do, because I've driven the route actually on two occasions when I've been on vacation over there, and to drive it is quite something.
Yeah,
love to do that one. Always wanted to run it.
Yeah. That just sounds nuts. Okay, what about a location that you've always wanted to run?
I think I refer back to my previous question. I want to run in New Zealand, because I'm running in New Zealand, it's the final stage. The finish line is in sight. And hopefully that £500,000 barrier for charity is also being smashed at the same time. So New Zealand is definitely somewhere I've always wanted to run.
Nice. Okay. I think when we spoke before, you mentioned that you, when you were a bit younger, you did a bit of, you're a bit quick as well. Like now you're doing a lot further distances. So when you were younger, did you do any track races, or was it all road or cross country, or what was it?
It was all road. The the quickest I ever got was 17 minutes for 3 miles.
Oh, nice. That's pretty quick. Yeah. It's quicker than me.
Measured it. You know, this is before Garmin watches. So drove the distance. So it had to be on a place where you could drive and measure the distance.
Yeah.
So it was all on roads.
Yeah. Okay. I was actually going to say, are these crazy, are these things that you've done on Strava or something?
Yes, they're on Garmin Connect.
All right, cool. I'll be on that. I'll see if I can just see the lines connected. That'll be nuts. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Right. What is your favorite sporting event that you've ever seen?
Ooh, well, it's got to be Newcastle United and football. So many great results among so many really poor results, admittedly. That's a really difficult question. I know this is a quick fire round, but favorite sporting event. I remember winning the championship in 2017.
Yeah.
I'd been to almost every game that season, only missed a handful, home and away.
Yeah.
And we won the championship title with seconds to go. A result elsewhere.
Wow.
Handed the title was Brighton, and Jack Grealish scoring a goal, handed the title to Newcastle.
Oh, man.
And after it was 3 minutes after our final whistle or so that their result came through. And I've never seen such an eruption of celebration. That's one that really sticks in my mind.
So just paint the picture just for me. So your final whistle goes, do all the players stay on the pitch? Is everybody still in the stadium?
Everyone's still in the stadium. Players are on the pitch. It's quite difficult to get a mobile phone signal. You just don't know what is going on in other games. I really don't know how I was alerted to the score other than possibly, I don't know, other people cheering.
Yeah.
And then it just took off from there. It was just having invested so much personally in a season.
Yeah.
You know, I was spent traveling to watch Newcastle that particular year.
Yeah.
It was just such a rewarding bonus to, you know, yes, getting promoted back to the top flight, but all of those miles were worth it. What a spectacular end to a sporting season.
Yeah.
It was tremendous.
That's amazing.
But yes, just last Sunday I got beat 5-1 at Tottenham and it was 4.5 hours of driving back for me on Sunday. So yeah, not great.
Yeah,
for every celebration there are at least 10 commiserations with Newcastle.
My goodness. That's rough. Okay, do you have a favorite athlete?
Well, the guy that I had, you know, the privilege of running with, a lot of people may not know about, he was called Jimmy Bell. He ran for Elsa Carriers. He sadly died in 2010 from cancer, but he was a really accomplished local runner. I think with cancer, he was still running half marathons in possibly 1:12, 1:13, something like that. He won a half marathon in the States, I remember, possibly a year, maybe less before he died. But he was the most humble human being I've ever met. You know, he would win some race on a weekend. You would never get to find out about it from Jim Bell. You know, you'd have to read about it in the newspaper or another colleague in the running scene would tell you what he'd achieved, but he was so humble, never boasted or bragged, but so talented as well. He only started running when he was 34 year old. Before that, it was beer and darts most nights, I believe. So from a 34-year-old, I think he was 62 when he died, sadly. But at 61, 62, he was still achieving great things in running and well-respected. I think there's possibly a run near Newburn on the local race calendar that's dedicated to his memory.
Wow.
So, yeah, for all your Alan Shearers and your Charlie Speddings that I've watched over the years.
Yeah.
Jimmy Bell, a humble human being, generous to a fault, and just, yeah, a superb, superb man, and definitely my favorite athlete.
Yeah, that's amazing. Fantastic. Okay, what running shoes did you use on all of these runs?
Well, there's one answer for 10,000 miles, and that's Brooks Glycerin.
Nice.
Glycerin 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I think we're on to 19 or 20 now, are we?
Yeah.
With Brooks Glycerin, you know, they support my weight when I'm running at my heaviest. And they've really changed over the years with the technology that I use. I don't begin to understand. But more importantly, I very rarely get injured.
Yeah.
Other than John O'Groats to Land's End, I don't recall really a running injury. Certainly in the training realm, you know, yes, I pick up a niggle because I'm running 40-odd miles, but not often, even then, not often. So, yeah, my trusty Brooks Glycerin that I still wear to this day, and I've got a pair for walking around in as well. Yeah. You know, after Australia, my feet had irreversible damage. I don't have any fatty padding at the bottom of my feet, so I've got very sensitive. If I walk on a wooden floor, you know, I really feel that. So I've got a pair of Brooks Glycerin to go to the match in, to go shopping in, etc. Yeah. So definitely my favorite running shoes, and long may that continue.
Yeah, no, fair enough. They're a really good shoe. So, yeah. What is your favorite movie?
Oh, Star Wars, without a shadow of a doubt.
Absolutely really?
mad on Star Wars. Yep.
What do you say, Forrest Gump?
Yeah. No, I would say that's second.
Fair enough. You know, I've never watched Star Wars.
So, yeah, I mean, I was what, 5-year-old when that came out. So,
yeah.
But yeah, love Star Wars, and just if ever I watch a Star Wars movie, I'm transported back to times that. You know, my mom took me to the cinema in 1977 to the Odeon in Newcastle for the first movie, and I thought it was quite something when I took my son to see the final Star Wars movie to the Odeon in the Metro Centre.
Wow.
So that had gone full circle. So
that's me.
But yeah, because I like Star Wars, I get Star Wars socks, Star Wars pants, you name it. I've got a Star Wars money box here that's been, you know. People seem to buy a lot of Star Wars things for me for Christmas. So.
Would you like more Star Wars or Newcastle United?
Oh, Newcastle. Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt.
It's not close. Okay, cool. All right. Do you have a favourite book?
I don't often get time to read, although I've just read a great book by Harry Pearson when I went on holiday the other week, a local writer. But there's a cyclist called Mark Beaumont, which I'm sure many people have heard of. He's got numerous books, but one of his first books, The Man Who Cycled the World, he cycled in 2007 when I was running John O'Groats to Land's End. But that's a great read, and it's a great insight into what he went through, being locked in prison overnight for his own protection in certain countries, being saddle sore across the Nullarbor Plain in Australia, and people giving him water when he'd run out. It's it's a really good read. And of course, after that, he went on to break the Round the World in 80 Days record and wrote about that. So yeah, there's a great series of books by Mark Beaumont, but that's the one that sticks in my mind. I've read that many, many times.
Wow, yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, I'll check that out then. Check that out. All right, a couple more questions. First of all, who is one athlete that you want to hear next on this podcast?
Ooh. Any famous name? Any big name?
Anyone.
Yeah, I mean, I tell you who I respect and find really exciting is Mark Cavendish.
Ooh, yeah.
And you know, if you... What's that saying? If you're old enough, you're good enough. If you're good enough, you're old enough. I don't know. But there's something along those lines. You know, he he did great things last year. In the twilight years of his career, you might say, but surrounded by a great team, you know, and I'm a huge believer in teamwork and having a support team as I've had, you know, I see the value in that. But yeah, Mark, if you can get hold of Mark Cavendish, although he's a cyclist, you know, he'd definitely be worth listening to.
Yeah. I'll reach out to him on DM and see what comes out of that. what is one thing that's still on your bucket list?
To raise £500,000 for charities in the northeast of England.
Yeah.
For me, that's the ultimate
thing,
to repay the debt of gratitude and to possibly end the journey that started in the most tragic of circumstances.
Yeah.
You know, I lost my mum in 1995, but my dad also died in 1988. My brother died from a brain hemorrhage in 1990. So all of those negative things, I decided to do something positive. And you know, the ultimate item on that bucket list is to repay a debt of gratitude and give back to people who looked after my family.
Yeah.
And if I can do that in terms of hundreds of thousands of pounds, attracting all of that generosity from so many people and funneling it towards good causes that are close to my heart, well, yeah, that's got to be a great bucket list item on anyone's on anyone's list.
Yeah, 100%. And finally, do you have any hidden talents?
I don't think so. I'm very much a one-trick pony.
Just know how to run.
Just cross-country running, and by that I mean running across countries. Yeah, I don't believe I have any hidden ones. It's all out there for everyone to see.
Fair enough.
One foot in front of the other. Get to the finish line.
Yeah, that's amazing.
If I have any hidden ones, I've yet to find them, but I'll let you know.
Fantastic. Well, before we finish then, do you have any advice for anyone that's getting into running, that's just listening to this and just like wants to, just get into running, get good at it and really improve?
I wouldn't know how to give any advice to anyone who wants to be really good, but I tell you what, I wish I'd been given one piece of advice, and that is to join a running club. You know, I'm running 5.5 minute miles as a 22-year-old. I wish I'd been picked up by a running club or joined a running club, and I could have won races possibly. I could have achieved things to some level. So yeah, join a running club. Surround yourself with those experts to help and guide, for sure, and not the likes of me. Don't take advice from me if you want to be really good.
Amazing. Awesome. Well, Mark, this has been fantastic. Actually, before we finish, where can people find you on social media? Where can they find the blog, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, so runjordyrun.com is the blog. You know, that's the jewel of the crown. And for 15, 16 years, I've been updating that with my various adventures. Search for Run Jordy Run on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube. And hopefully I'll be ramping up the YouTube content over the coming years.
Yeah.
So yeah, search for Run Jordy Run in a Google image search, and you'll see me as heavy as 18.5 stone and as light as 13 stone.
Oh, that's fantastic. Awesome. So Run Jordy Run, all over social media, runjordyrun.com. Fantastic. Yeah, and everybody listening as well, make sure you follow Ardent Run Club on Instagram and at This Is Ardent on all of our social media platforms, just for updates on us over here at Ardent and updates on the podcast, so you can be the first to know when the new weekly episodes come out. Any last words, Mark?
No, it's been a pleasure being on the podcast. Really enjoyed it. It's been quite therapeutic, actually. So if you ever fancy going into counselling, I think you could make a good stab at that. You seem to be a very good listener, but you know, I've really enjoyed it. It's you know, it's always great to recount all of the miles that have been run so far.
Yeah.
And try and come to terms with, you know, those miles that are still to be run in the future and all of those funds that are still to be raised. It's going to be quite an adventure if the previous 10,000 miles are anything to go by, that's for sure.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, guys, this has been Ardent Run Club episode 69 with Mark Allison, who runs in the family. See you next time. Thank you.